Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Welcome and good morning. First case before us this morning is State of Ohio versus Aaron Ritchie. Mr. Keeling.
Chief Justice Brown, and may it please the court, Ms. Tobias. Appellant would reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. 95% to 98% of the convictions that are obtained in this state are the result of guilty or no contest pleas. And the law has long held that such pleas must be knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered in order to be valid. The issue before this court today is whether a plea can be knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered if the legislature can later drastically change the consequences that directly attach to the entering of such a plea.
Counsel, if we deal with Bodike in a manner that would invalidate its retroactive application, is your case still before us?
It would not, because the increased requirements would not apply then.
Okay, so that is basically the crux of it. You're not asking us to say in any specific or in any occasion if the legislature changes the sentencing or the post-release or things such as reporting and registration. You're concentrating strictly on the statute that is labeled the Adam Walsh Act.
We are, Your Honor.
Okay.
Nick Consul, I'm wondering on the merits of what you present to us, how knowing and intelligent would you have to be in order to foresee future action of the legislature? I mean, isn't that an impossible standard?
Nobody can foretell the future, and particularly when you're talking about what the legislature might enact.
Yeah.
But
so you're asking us to adopt some impossible standard, aren't you?
No, we're just saying that when a person is entering a guilty plea, in order to be knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered, they have to be aware of the consequences that attach to it. Certainly, they should be aware of direct consequences.
That standard can only apply to the law as the judge and the defense attorney and the prosecutor would know it at the time.
Right, and you can't know what future changes might be made. It's like entering into a contract. Can a party later unilaterally change the terms of a contract and bind the other person? And the answer is no, because that contract wouldn't be effective. The agreement, what you gave up and in turn what you were getting in that contract, if you change that, then that's not the term of the contract. You didn't knowingly enter into that agreement. This person changed it.
What didn't the client know when he pled, I believe, no contest to this?
Unfortunately, there's a lot that this client didn't know, and in part it was because his attorney.
Yeah, I understand what happened with the attorney, and that's a whole different topic of whether or not the attorney was appropriate in withdrawing and for whatever reason, et cetera. But you're saying that 2 years later, he wants to withdraw his plea because he never knowingly, intelligently pled in light of the changed reporting and registration requirements of Adam Walsh, because Megan's Law was in place when he was sentenced.
It was.
So you're saying he knowingly pled to the Megan's Law consequences, because you're not arguing that to us. You're saying once the statute changed and the reporting requirements and the registration changed, then he said, this isn't what I bargained for, and I want out.
It wasn't. It wasn't the term that.
Well, of course it wasn't, because it wasn't on the books. So he couldn't, as Justice Pfeiffer said, you can't use a crystal ball and say, I'm in for what the current legislation is, and if in the future they make it more severe or there's a different consequence to my guilty, the finding of guilt, then maybe I want to
think you have to understand that when a person, you have a presumption that a person knows the law, whether that's true or not is always another issue. But at the time you enter a guilty plea, you do it knowing there's only certain things that the state can do to you. And you do it, and you're giving up important rights. You're giving up your right to a jury trial, the right for the state to prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the right to present witnesses, to testify on your own behalf or not to testify. You're giving up all those rights in return for a known set of consequences. If you give up all those rights and then the state later changes what it can do to you, how is that ever? How can you ever
say
you know
anything? You're not saying that he, just in light of the dimensions of the Adam Walsh Act, triggers the ability to withdraw your plea. You're saying that had your client known at the time he pled and was sentenced that there was the possibility that the legislature could change some of the ramifications, and that has to be explained to a client at the time they're sentenced, that what you're sentenced to now, you understand, could change in the future. Is that what you're asking?
I think the better part of the law is when you enter a guilty plea, these are, and there are certain consequences that are attached, that's what the state's going to do to you. I know of no other area of law. I gave the example about a municipal corporation entering into a contract with a builder to say we need a new municipal building. Then city council changes the law and says, well, all municipal buildings have to be constructed of marble and made earthquake resistant and have all these other features, which more than would double, maybe triple the price of the building. Does that contractor, does he have to build that building as under the terms that the city council passed? No, that would never be the case in any, and this is exactly what's happening here. The state.
Well, counsel, I'm trying to figure out what is, what would you have us write here? Is this a different type of attack on Senate Bill 10 than is present in Bodike? Are you coming at it from
just
a slightly
simple,
different direction?
It's just a simple case of a person has to be able to knowingly and intelligently and voluntarily enter a guilty plea in order for it to be binding. Nobody can do that if the state maintains some illusory power or some real power to change the terms of what the ramifications are.
So
later.
So this case,
drastically,
if we were to hold in Bodike that what the legislature did was okay and constitutional in every respect,
then
you would use this case to say it still couldn't apply to anyone sentenced before the law changed.
People who were sentenced before that did not get what they bargained for, and if they would not have pled guilty or no contest knowing these things, then they're entitled to withdraw.
So you would set aside all convictions under Senate, or
no,
the application of Senate Bill 10 to everyone who was convicted and sentenced prior to the enactment and effective date of Senate Bill 10 on the basis that they did not knowingly enter their plea, or
it would be up to the individual to make that application, I believe.
So if they went to trial and were convicted, you don't even, they would have a different
result
than
if they went to trial.
That.
They did not give up. You don't have the issue about the knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently.
So under your scenario, you could have two different outcomes for folks. If we were to say that Senate Bill 10 is constitutional in every respect, if we, by your argument, folks who entered a plea would have a better outcome than folks who went to trial.
Maybe, maybe not. It depends on what happened afterwards.
Okay.
But at least they would be entitled to justice, which you don't have when you enter a plea expecting there are certain limitations. In this case, the obligations and reporting requirements are far more onerous than the penalties for the offense.
Mr. Keeling, you're really making another attack on the retroactivity of Adam Walsh, in effect, because under Rule 11, taking a plea, the defendant is to understand the maximum penalty, the consequences, the effect of the plea.
The United States Supreme Court came out with a decision on March 31st of this year, just in time for me to include it in the reply brief, and that was Padilla versus Kentucky. That was a case where the defendant entered a guilty plea to a drug trafficking. He had been a legal, an alien resident of this country for 40 years. He had served honorably in Vietnam. And at the time, he was not advised properly by his attorney about the deportation consequences of entering that plea. He then, when he found out he was going to be deported and there was nothing he could do about that, he attempted to set aside that plea. The Kentucky Supreme Court said that he couldn't do that because deportation was just a collateral consequence of entering that plea. The Supreme Court of the United States said the Kentucky Supreme Court was wrong. And they looked at this and they didn't like the term that was used, collateral so much or direct. They said it. You have to look at the consequences. And what they did is they said that they had never applied a distinction between direct and collateral consequences to define what is constitutionally mandated with respect to right to counsel and entering of a guilty plea. And they said deportation as a consequence of a criminal conviction is, because of its close connection to the criminal process, uniquely difficult to classify as either a direct or collateral consequences. They recognized that deportation proceedings were civil in nature, not a criminal sanction, but noted that they were intimately related to the criminal process. So that case is very instructive on the whole issue here, where you're talking in the states maintaining that this is collateral, because the Supreme Court says it doesn't matter whether something is labeled as a direct or collateral consequences. What matters is whether the consequence is significant and closely connected to the criminal process.
Mr. Keeling, you've touched on an issue that has raised itself several times on the criminal or civil nature of what we're talking about with Adam Walsh. So you're saying, based on that U.S. Supreme Court case, that may not even be a relevant matter for us if we were to determine that this is actually a consequence of the crime.
This is far different than deportation as being attaching to criminal conviction. Those are totally separate, and you can argue even distinct processes. The requirements that attach to a sexual offense convictions aren't so much collateral. They're directly related to the conviction, because without the conviction, you don't have any of those requirements.
So you would not give up, or what is your position on the punitive?
Position is this, is that a person is entitled to know certain things, even, you know, consequences that are existing at the time as far as whether or not this guilty plea might result in deportation consequences. The Supreme Court said this, had he known, he may not have entered that guilty plea. So attorney is obligated to advise him of these things, and a person, you know, it follows that the person is entitled to know these things in order for it to be knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently entered. The Supreme Court said that these are the things that make a guilty plea knowingly or intelligently and voluntarily entered when you have to judge it. Now, the thing that's different here is these are facts that are known at the time. But when you have facts, nobody could have advised the defendant of what some future consequences might be that are severe. I mean, and these aren't just minor bookkeeping things. These have an impact upon his life. They determine where he can live and where he can work. And they're going to be determinative of his freedom in large part, because this person was not an individual with... He's going to have trouble complying with the complex reporting requirements, and he already has once. And as I stand here now, he's a homeless individual.
Mr. Ritchie, you continue to attack the plea, but you want to withdraw the plea, and isn't your standard to show manifest injustice?
That's the standard, and it's manifestly unjust to increase essentially what amounts to tremendous burdens, place tremendous
we
burdens
upon the
defendant.
We have said this is not a penalty, and this court has indicated it is a civil remedy.
Well, the Supreme Court noted that.
There have been numerous appellate courts that have indicated that the consequences of being classified as a sexual offender don't become part of the plea colloquy. I'm sure you're familiar with that line of cases.
Yes, but that's...
You want us to overrule all those cases and change all that case law and make this criminal somehow just in this case.
I would like the court to pay close attention to what the United States Supreme Court said in Padilla. And what they said is that deportation was civil, and it wasn't part of the criminal process, but it was still enough to warrant the defendant not knowing about that deportation could affect the knowingly, involuntary, and intelligent nature of his guilty plea. And they remanded it to the Kentucky courts for that determination.
Yes, but your client knew of the registration requirements and knew of the notification.
Not.
And the only change is a longer term, right?
Well, I'm not going to say he knew of the when he entered his no contest plea, the judge says, you know, there might be some registration requirements, kind of didn't tell him what it was, and didn't say for sure it would. He said there might be.
Yes, but there's no obligation on the court to go into all of that.
Later, at sentencing, after he'd already entered the no contest plea, they gave more elaborate instructions.
Would you have us promulgate a rule of law that says the next time a common pleas court judge accepts a plea in a sex offender case, that court must go through the Rule 11 colloquy and advise completely about all of the requirements under Adam Walsh?
No, I'm asking the court to...
Well, you're admitting then that's not part of the plea
colloquy. I'm asking the court to fashion a rule that if a person enters a plea to a criminal offense and the legislature then drastically changes the consequences of entering that plea, that that plea can't be considered to be knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently entered because those consequences were not in existence at the time he entered that plea.
Well, counsel, I'm not so sure that focusing on the consequences, the registration and the distance from a school and, you know, living conditions is really your best argument here. I would look at the enhanced penalty for violating the registration, which would be jumping from a misdemeanor, equivalent to the degree of misdemeanor that we had here, to an F4 under the Adam Walsh Act, which is, I think, probably a better example of an unknown yet enhanced consequence to the change in the legislation. Whether you've got to register for 15 years or 20 years or 25 or you know, all those incidentals, I don't know where the most onerous aspect of this. It's the consequences for failing to comply that I think might be your best argument.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for pointing that out. And that's the most important thing to my client because, as Justice Stratton knows, we have people who are in the margins of society that because of certain limitations, they have difficulty in complying with certain requirements. And the ones imposed here are onerous. Sometimes homeless people don't carry a calendar with them. And there are other problems that make violating a higher probability for some people. Not because they're just not able to function in the same manner that other people function. And this is a person who might fit in that category, and it's very important because if that person had been known what would happen for violating these things, and if he'd had an attorney knew, there's no way that this plea should ever have been entered. If he'd have been represented by an attorney, no attorney would enter a plea to such a minor crime that carries such onerous consequences because there's no risk. There's no risk in going to trial on something like that.
Thank you, Mr. Keeley.
Thank you.
Ms. Tobias.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice Brown, Honorable Justices. May it please the Court, Melanie Tobias, Assistant City Prosecutor on behalf of Columbus City Attorney Richard C. Pfeiffer, Jr. There's nothing in the record in this case to demonstrate that Mr. Ritchie was somehow induced to enter his no contest plea in 2006 because of the sex offender registration scheme as it existed in 2006. As the court was discussing with Mr. Keeling, there was no discussion, there was a back and forth between the court and Mr. Ritchie regarding the fact that he was going to have to register as a sex offender. So there's nothing to demonstrate that he knew what the registration requirements were and that current status of those registration requirements prodded him on.
He didn't know that he was going to be subject to Megan's Law of registration requirements when he pled no contest to this activity.
Well, there's a contradiction in the record. When Mr. Ritchie filed his motion to withdraw his plea and submitted his affidavit to the court, in his affidavit, he affirmed and swore to the fact that he did not know. So his assertion to the trial court in his criminal rule 32.1 motion was, I had no idea in 2006 when I entered my no contest plea that I was going to have to register as a sex offender. I didn't know that my information would be on the internet. I didn't know that it would be a penalty not to register. And if I had known that...
Is there evidence that says in the record that the sentencing judge did advise him of all of those things?
What the record shows is that at the time the court was having a discussion with the defendant about entering a plea, so he had not yet entered his no contest plea, the judge did tell him that there was a possibility that he would have to register as a sex offender as a consequence for entering that no contest plea.
Was that accurate information?
Not that it was going to be a possibility.
Right. It was a certainty.
Right.
And so, I mean, there's a big difference between the word possibility and you know, you may have to register as opposed to, hey, guess what? You're going to have to register, and here's the consequences. Wasn't he entitled to know that information to begin with?
No, he was not. And the law of Ohio in 2006, when under Senate Bill 5 version of the sex offender registration, did not require the court to notify the defendant of all of his registration requirements before taking a plea.
Although Criminal Rule 11 specifically tells the trial judge that you must tell the defendant what the effects of the plea are, and you don't see that registration, mandatory registration for a long period of time is not part of the effect of a plea.
Correct, Your Honor, except this court in State v. Jones in 2007 clarified the Criminal Rule 11 requirements with respect to entering a plea on a petty offense. Mr. Ritchie entered a plea to a third-degree misdemeanor sexual imposition charge. It's a petty offense. So under State v. Jones, the court was only required to advise the defendant as to the effect of his plea with respect to it being a no-contest plea versus a guilty plea. The court was not required to go through an extensive colloquy with the defendant with respect to the maximum penalty, waiving all the specific rights of a trial in terms of calling witnesses, cross-examination, what the maximum fine could be. And the court certainly was not required to advise the defendant of all of the specific registration requirements.
Well, this case isn't about what a trial judge should advise a sex offender at the time of a plea. Your point is that at the time this plea was taken, this defendant did not rely on a representation of the court as to what the sexual reporting requirements would be. Isn't that your argument?
Correct. He did not rely on that. Because
the court didn't explain it to him, and therefore it wasn't part of the plea agreement. Therefore, there's no breach of the plea agreement.
Correct.
This is simply a legislative change to increase the length of term of registration and change the notification requirements.
Correct. The appellant's argument is that the change under Senate Bill 10 radically altered this contractual bargain that he had struck with the state.
Your argument is that this
wasn't
part of the bargain.
Correct.
So therefore, it's a specious argument.
How do you deal with the U.S. Supreme Court case that says that not knowing is not definitive? You should have known. You should have been advised if there is a definite penalty that is going to affect your future. And the Adam Walsh Act certainly increased the penalties quite dramatically. And the U.S. Supreme Court said it doesn't matter if it's civil or criminal, and it doesn't matter that you don't know. How does that affect this case?
Well, the Padilla case, the court was looking specifically at the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. And the lower courts had held that the attorney's failure to advise, or in fact, specifically, the attorney gave erroneous advice to his client in Padilla, telling him that he would not be deported. The lower courts held that that was not enough to demonstrate the first prong of the Strickland test, that was deficient performance by counsel. So the U.S. Supreme Court was looking solely at the isolated issue of did that constitute deficiency of performance.
But if it didn't matter to him that he was going to be deported, then there would be no ineffective assistance of counsel. It's the knowledge of the deportation that made the counsel ineffective, just like you would infer the knowledge of the Adam Walsh Act here would have a consequence.
Yes, Your Honor, you are correct in that that was why counsel's performance was deficient, because the knowledge about the deportation consequences was so important. But I think the U.S. Supreme Court in the Padilla decision really places the issue of deportation in a completely separate category from other collateral consequences. And they did discuss the fact that you can't just end the analysis by saying, oh, it's just a civil collateral consequence. Deportation is akin to banishment and exile. And in fact, for many defendants who are faced with a criminal conviction and are making a decision as to whether or not to go to trial or to enter a plea, whether or not they're going to be deported.
The Adam Walsh Act isn't very far from banishment and exile.
Well, I disagree with you respectfully, Your Honor, that you're not being physically removed from the country. You are not being physically removed from your family. And the U.S. Supreme Court specifically focused on the fact that 29 states plus the District of Columbia already had legislation in place. Ohio is one of them, mandating a court to advise a defendant prior to his plea of possible deportation consequences. Again, the court pointed out that the risk of being deported is more important to these defendants than actually being incarcerated and what their jail penalty would be or their incarceration penalty, that they are more concerned, and understandably so, with whether or not they would be deported. And then again, this is reflected in the fact that 29 states and the District of Columbia have legislation mandating this pre-advisement, this pre-plea advisement to a defendant so that they can be aware of this very unique, very special, burdensome collateral consequence.
Counsel, when you carry that argument a little further, don't you think a defendant would be more concerned about being prohibited from living in certain areas, that would be concerned about having to report to sheriffs where he or she is living, and that even if you move into an area for more than a period of time, whatever county you go to, you have to register there? I mean, we're talking about consequences that are much greater than the 60 days this defendant originally got in his sentence, 60 days and a $500 fine for, as you said, a petty offense, with the possibility that if there's a violation, it's now a fourth-degree felony for a violation. And you don't see any of those new consequences as being more important than 60 days in jail?
It's possible, Your Honor, but it is also possible that a defendant would be more concerned with whether or not he's going to be going to jail for 60 days. Registering in the future is something that the defendant could say, you know, I can do that, I can comply with that. But in the specific facts of this case, there's nothing to demonstrate that Mr. Ritchie was concerned with that.
Because he wasn't told.
Right, and he wasn't required to be told. And the court's not required to advise.
He was told. He was told that he might be. So I guess the court would have been better served by not saying anything instead of giving out misinformation.
Well, here's what happened. The court said that he might have to register as a sex offender as a possible collateral consequence. The defendant did not say anything to the court, did not inquire any further. He entered his no contest plea. The case was set out for sentencing so a pre-sentence investigation report could be done. When he came back on his sentencing date, he was actually then at that point specifically informed, signed the forms, and they are in the record, indicating that he was aware of his sex offender registration requirements. There were two different forms given to him that were very explicit. Again, he says nothing. He doesn't voice an objection to the court. He doesn't ask to withdraw his plea at that time. He says nothing about it, and then waits another 2 years before he attempts to vacate his plea. So if he really didn't have any idea of his sex offender registration requirements and that would have been the sole determinative factor regarding his decision to enter a plea, why all the silence and why the length of time? And that silence and that length of time was something that the trial court took into consideration. I think the facts in this record more accurately support a conclusion that the defendant ended up getting charged with a felony for failing to register in May of 2008. And it wasn't until that point that he realized maybe it wasn't such a good idea that I entered this plea a couple years ago. And he's explicitly told the trial court at his criminal rule 32.1 motion hearing that he was hoping to get out of that felony by getting his plea withdrawn on the misdemeanor case.
Ms. Tobias, turning you to the Bodike situation, depending on how this court rules in Bodike, whether we rule that the law may not constitutionally be applied retroactively or vice versa, would you agree with opposing counsel that the determination in Bodike would basically moot this case?
Yes, I would. If this court determines that the statutory scheme is unconstitutional, then the defendant's the only proposition of law in front of this court is with respect to those Senate Bill 10 amendments. They would not apply to Mr. Ritchie any longer, and this appeal would be moot.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions from the court? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kaling, would you like 30 seconds?
Thank you. I'd like to address the issue. I think it's a matter of contract law. A person's entitled to the benefit of his bargain, even if he doesn't fully understand all the terms and conditions of his bargain. If I go and order a cheeseburger, the server says, well, you know how much that is? And I said, no. And he says, well, I'm going to charge you $50. And I look at the menu and say, it's $5. He said, well, I changed the price after you ordered. And I said, well, that's not what I bargained for. Because I think the terms would say you got the bargain is what, even if you didn't know it at the time, is what said at the menu when you ordered it. And this is the same thing. He did not get what he bargained for as the terms existed as a matter of law. And that's why the plea is not voluntary. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly.